So this is an English conversation we are going to have today in Follow the Rechtsstaat, our podcast hosted by Privacy in Germany Ping. And we're going to talk about privacy today. We're going to talk about privacy a lot. We're going to talk today about an author of a book called The Public Parts, which doesn't sound privacy-like at all. I'm very happy to talk today to Jeff Jarvis in New York. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. How are you, Digger?
Just for our audience who may or may not have come across you, I can't believe it is possible to follow online developments without coming across your name, but who knows? You are a journalist, professor as well of journalism, and have published various books, some of which I happen to have read. One about Google, which is nearly 15 years ago, if I recall correctly. The one about public parts is not explicitly, but it is about Facebook, a few years later. And you have recently published a book with the title The Gutenberg Parenthesis. And now I'm going to do something which I really hate to do. I have read the first 50 pages, but no further. Just a quick word on what that book is about.
So The Gutenberg Parenthesis, and by the way, I'm seeking a German publisher still, is a book from Bloomsbury, in which I take a theory from three academics at the University of Southern Denmark that the age of print was an exception in history. It was the parenthesis. And that as we leave the age of print, doesn't mean print dies. It doesn't mean that we forget what we learned in the age of print. But as we leave it for the digital age that follows, we have much to learn from the entry into the age of print. And so I write a loving history of print and its development and its spread and its meaning, and then try to adapt what I learned there to various questions around ideas that came from the age of print, like the notion of content and copyright with it and so on. The idea that society before print, especially before mechanized, industrialized print, was highly conversational, and we lost that. And also a notion that I abhor, which is the idea of the mass and mass media, which I think is an insult to people. And so then I ask at the end how we need to reconsider, in some cases reinvent and replace, the institutions that came along in print, some of which are quite necessary, some of which we miss and need, but that are not up to the scale of speech today.
I remember an essay you wrote a few years ago, also with Gutenberg in the title, with the great thought that if you sort of compare the Gutenberg age to our age, we're just seeing the beginning of the internet, and we have no idea what is to come.
That's part of my argument, is that we think that the change we're undergoing today is so rapid and so huge, but that's somewhat the hubris of the present tense. If you think back to the change that must have occurred in people's minds when print started spreading across towns across Europe, changing so much about how people perceived the world, yet it took a full century and a half after movable type, from 1450s to 1600, before we saw this incredible rush of innovation with print. The invention of the modern novel with Cervantes, the invention of the essay with Montaigne, of a market for printed plays with Shakespeare, and of the newspaper. The fact that that took a century and a half to develop amazed me and makes me think that we still see in the internet the future and the analog of the past, and we haven't begun to understand what it and AI are, what we can do with them. Now, I want to be clear here that I'm not a technological determinist. There is no sure path of where we go. History does not repeat itself. We have decisions to make. And so my point is that we should, I think, look back to the lessons of the past to inform the decisions that we must make today.
Now I have the job of leading on to what we're going to talk about now, which is a very hot topic, causing a lot of controversy in everybody who's interested in digital affairs, and of course in the platform industry as well as the media industry here. This is an opinion issued by the European Data Protection Board a week ago, brand new, April 17th, and long expected on the pay models that are implemented, as it says, by large online platforms. This is mainly Meta, that this is opinion, which is 42 pages long, and you can see when you read it that a lot of work has gone into it. And the question that this is all about is whether what Meta does now in reaction to the Bundeskartellamt decision by the European Court of Justice last July, that they are offering the services as they always have with behavioral advertising, but also offer an alternative which is which costs. Yeah. And the European Board is saying that this is again in violation of the GDPR. And because well, there are a lot of arguments why that is so, but the sort of core argument is that if the only way to continue using Facebook or Instagram is to pay, this is not a free and voluntary decision according to the terms of the GDPR. And your instant reaction, if I may say so, to this was, I mean, in my words, you didn't say so, but this is how it came across to me was the Europeans are going crazy.
That's one way to translate it, yes. So I was thinking about this in preparation for this conversation. So I want to quickly do, I think, 4 points. The first is that I think to call advertising targeting surveillance is ludicrous. In fact, I find it offensive. Surveillance is what the Stasi did. Surveillance is what China does. Surveillance is what the successor to the KGB does, with the power of government and law, arms and jail behind it. Cookies are not surveillance. I have a new book coming out in the fall called The Web We Weave, also looking for a German publisher. And, you know, in it, I look at these questions. And for that book, I had to suffer through reading the 700 pages of Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism book, which I found just absolutely insufferable, in which it's a bunch of hyperbole trying to make this argument that advertising targeting is a violation and a risk and a danger. And I'm sorry, but knowing whether or not you looked at certain boots and those boots might follow you around may be irritating. And this words of some even creepy, but it's not surveillance. It's not damaging. And I think this has been blown way out of proportion. And so the basis of all this is that ad targeting is somehow an evil. And I don't think it is. Point one. Point two, if authorities in Europe are going to argue that ad targeting is bad, then I think they should argue it is bad for everybody, which would include, quickly to add, media companies, which if it were done against them would be screaming bloody murder because they need targeting to have more efficient advertising to compete with the possibilities of online now. And then third point is that I find it odd for a governmental body to get into the point of trying to manage a company in such tactical detail. This is what you may do. This is what you may not do. So Meta has made their business off of targeted advertising. The EU says, well, you can't do that. You have to allow people out of that. Meta should not be forced to give the service for free, to make no money on it. I think that's quite ridiculous, anti-capitalistic. So Meta says, fine, if you don't want the advertising, okay, then we'll give you a paid-for version without that targeted advertising. And then, of course, the EU says, no, you can't do that. The government says you can't do that. Which leads to a fourth thing. Why is Meta called out? And I couldn't find this in any of the writing. I saw this in, you know, secondhand in someone writing about this decision. So correct me if I'm wrong here. But I saw some reference to the idea that Facebook is a necessary service. And so to charge people for it is wrong. Well, I don't know how necessary Facebook is. I would say that the news is a necessary service. And by extension, one should ask whether or not the news should be offered for free as well, because we need that. So the logic of this whole decision just throws me off, where I think it's a response to a bit of moral panic about the internet in the forms of arguing that targeting is surveillance, a bit of frankly anti-technology, anti-American perspective or bias, one might say. And so I just didn't see the overarching logic. I saw in this decision only emotion.
Let's start with your first point, surveillance. And the book you just mentioned is, that's a U.S. author, Surveillance Capitalism.
Yes. Yes.
So this is not something that is only criticized in Europe, and the notion of Facebook and others being the equivalent of Stasi when they do targeted advertising using loads of cookies and stuff, that is something that is very controversial in the United States these days as well, isn't it?
In some quarters, yes. I think you find the anti-internet, anti-Facebook, Meta, Google et al. Cabal finds this awful. But I think it is, as I say, a sign of moral panic, of trying to blame something. And there's one school that says the internet is to blame for our children's misery, ignoring the fact that they're worried about the climate and the economy and in America losing autonomy over their bodies. There's others who try to claim that the internet is to blame for disinformation and lying and hate, as if we were never had hate before the internet and we didn't bring our hate to the internet. And then there are those who look at it from an economic perspective and say that there's this evil of surveillance. So in my book, The Web We Weave, coming out in October, I quote from Zuboff saying that surveillance is, and these are quotes, a new economic order that claims human experience as free raw material for hidden commercial practices of extraction, prediction, and sales, a parasitic economic logic, unprecedented in human history, a significant threat to human nature, which is best understood as a coup from above and overthrow of people's sovereignty. Get a grip. This is just so overblown, so ridiculous. Now, you know, we see obviously in Europe has privacy regulation that we still don't have in the US. GDPR exists. GDPR, I think, is in some ways good and in some ways bad legislation, but it's now quite accepted. But I think it's getting interpreted in overblown ways. We should look at the actual harm in these cases and the harm on both sides, the harm to the user of their interest in boots having been recorded and used for targeting, and the harm to the companies and media companies and culture as a whole, if this is taken away, and what that does to public discourse and culture.
Mm-hmm. Looking back the last 10 years, the notion of Facebook and others spying on you and of this being a surveillance issue, it has expanded, or there are more people these days, I would think, that would instantly agree with that than today. Do you have an explanation for that?
Yes, I'm actually going to blame Rupert Murdoch. Because some years ago, I'm trying to find this right now, I can't in my book, the Wall Street Journal started a campaign against the humble cookie. Now, mind you, a cookie is necessary for the web to operate. It's how a web browser knows and a server know that you should get the next piece of content that you asked for, that you're the same person who signed in, that you shouldn't see the same ad 100 times because you've already seen it, and so on. Cookies are vital to the operation of the web. They were then used for the purposes of advertising. And the Wall Street Journal some years ago did a series that demonized the cookie, that said, oh my God, this is a secret and terrible thing that's happening. It wasn't a secret at all. And look how many cookies there are, and look what it's doing to you, and look how it's watching you. And it was very emotional language. Rupert Murdoch has failed miserably at the internet. I know because I worked for that company for a while at one of the failures called Delphi Internet. And I've watched since that what Murdoch has done is give up on advertising as the primary support for his business, moving to subscription, and then trying to pull the ladder up and affect others. And so it became a strategy at the Wall Street Journal to attack Google and to attack that advertising model and to attack the underpinnings that were necessary for it. So it all started on a date that I can't find at the moment, but there's a date certain when this began with the Wall Street Journal attacking the cookie as some kind of evil. And then it fit into a larger narrative of, oh my God, these tech companies are too big and too powerful, which is a discussion we can have, but an effort to find dastardly action from them. And so the cookie and this notion of surveillance were then used as an effort to bring evidence of a sort to the argument that they were bad and had to be controlled. It's fine to have a discussion about regulation of the internet, fine to have a discussion about big companies in power. One of the ironies of especially European regulation is that it intends to take away power from the platforms, but often gives more power to them. The right to be forgotten means that Google is now in the position to decide what is and is not linked to and remembered by the web unilaterally without due process or appeal. Power demanded, placed on them by government. Same with NetzDG in Germany. Now Meta has the unilateral power to decide what is and is not hate speech and manifestly illegal speech without courts, without due process, without appeal except to the oversight board. That's the irony of much of this regulation, is that it ends up only making the tech platforms more powerful. This is a history that goes way, way back to print, when it became too difficult for governments to monitor and control all the speech that was occurring thanks to Gutenberg, and they had to install intermediaries to control it. In the case of the UK, it was the Stationers' Company, was licensed to decide what could and could not be printed and who was not responsible for that. So it's a game that goes back whenever speech expands, and there is a moral panic about that and a desire by those who have held power to continue to control speech.
You mentioned the NetzDG. And the irony about the NetzDG in Germany is that after the NetzDG was in place, we started to have many, many court cases of people who were not happy with their content being erased, with them being completely blocked or thrown off the platforms, which I think proves your point that with the NetzDG, the platforms started to police content. And that was not always met by, they were sometimes right and sometimes they were wrong. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I was part of a task force looking at transatlantic regulation. It was a very long title, the Transatlantic High-Level Working Group on Content Moderation and Freedom of Expression Online. Take a breath. And in that, we came up with a framework for regulation that I endorse, that I think is very good. One of its pillars, proposed by someone who went on to become the chief judge of the European Court of Human Rights, he's since left the court, was the proposal to start what he called e-courts. And he argued that if speech is going to be called illegal, and by the way, as an American with the First Amendment, I am somewhat troubled by that notion of illegal speech, but it's different in Europe. If speech is to be decreed illegal, that should be done only in the courts, where people have full transparency, where they have due process, and where they have the right of appeal and the right of evidence. And so he proposed starting what he called e-courts, where matters of legality of speech would be decided in new and efficient and small courts that could be paid for by taxes to platforms. You know, in a way, we'll be taking over some of the worst of what we expect of them as intermediaries. But the way it's happening now in private companies is not, I think, a constitutional, in many senses of the word, process.
I agree that, getting back to pay or okay, I agree that in spite of all the regulation that we have seen in the past 10 years, the platforms have, against all expectations, not become less powerful, but more powerful. And I find it very interesting to discuss the reasons why that is so. The GDPR was promoted by the Commission in 2016. One of their strongest arguments was this is level playing ground with the US companies. The idea was that once the GDPR was in place and everybody had to follow the rules, it would be easier for the European companies to compete with the internet giants. And this is an expectation that has not really become reality. Just to sort of, I think I have an idea of why the EDP PB and the data protection authorities that called for this statement, why they put so much work and effort into this paper. There comes the European Court of Justice, for better or worse, and says, no, Facebook, this is against the GDPR. If you argue that as targeted advertising is part of your services, you can argue that the requirements of a, or the provisions of a contractual service are met, which would be sufficient according to GDPR. So Meta had a problem after the ECJ ruling. They had to change their model. And then there is this, was the sentence in the ECJ judgment that said, well, that this was not strictly necessary for the provision of the platform services. One of the options might be an alternative with a fee. So Meta, I mean, they didn't really, it took them very, very short time when they had this pay or okay model and asking people to pay 6 or 10 euros per month for using their services. And of course, they had hardly any subscriptions. And so from the perspective of a regulator, this is another dirty trick that they are playing here to try and not to play with the rules. That is certainly the, I'm sure that this is how this is seen. And this is that that's the explanation why they put so much time and effort in the statement. Would you say it was a wise move to come out and say, well, we have heard you, ECJ. If you want to continue to use Instagram without advertising, please pay 10 euros a month.
So the irony of this is that among the allies of Shoshana Zuboff, who were screaming about how advertising is targeting and evil, one of them is a moral entrepreneur, as they're called, a moral panicker named Tristan Harris, who I don't much like what he has to say. But one thing he has to say is that advertising is the root of the evil here, and that the services should get rid of advertising and should instead charge. That side has been arguing that for some time. Now, one problem I have with that is that's a position of privilege. That's saying that, oh, well, you can afford to buy this service, but people, especially in some countries where Facebook is a primary means of connecting, can't necessarily afford to. And so getting it for free through advertising was a benefit. And it was a white man's privilege to say that everyone should pay. But the irony is, of course, that Meta then provides a mechanism for people to pay instead of have advertising. And then they get in trouble for that. They can't win either way. I think to your earlier point about this relationship in terms of the expectation that this was going to create a level playing field, I think the problem is threefold. One, the scale is so big, and that's why governments can't manage this themselves. That's why they have to have intermediaries do it. Thus, the second point, we have a doctrine of intermediary liability, that governments will make the platforms responsible for what people do on them in general. That's where we get to NetzDG and so on. In the US, we have Section 230, which exempts platforms from that so that we can have public discourse. I think it is very wise legislation, but it also is under attack in the US. This leads us to the third point, which is regulatory capture. That when you're operating at this scale and you put on this kind of regulation, expecting these intermediaries to do the bidding of government, that's very expensive. It's very difficult. It requires all kinds of equipment and staff and policy people and so on. Who has that ability? Big companies, Meta and Google and in the day, Twitter and so on. And so that ironically does not create a level playing field. Quite to the contrary, it ends up cutting out future, smaller, newer competitors.
That is ironic. The word I...
Sorry, Google thought I was talking to it.
That's a well, clear sign of surveillance, I would say.
Yes.
Somebody was listening. The European Data Protection Board is an opinion that they have issued. It is not the law. I mean, even if this becomes final, a court and it will in doubt be the ECG at the end of the day, may take a different view. So you could argue, well, this is the job of the data protection board in Europe is to be as strict in protection, the protection of privacy in Europe as possible. That is their job. So it makes sense that they don't let Meta get away with this trick of paying a fee that they know hardly anybody will be paying.
I don't know that they thought that no one would be paying it. I think that you listen to the privacy advocates in Europe, there was a bit of a call for this, of giving us an ad-free option. But it's ridiculous for then the government to turn around and say, well, it has to be ad-free for free. Then how does Meta make money? They're offering a free service to people. You're telling them they're not allowed to make money. That's just simply absurd. It's also important to mention, I think, another factor that's coming to the fore here is because of this moral panic around advertising cookies and privacy, Google has worked for what it's been calling the sandbox, an alternative structure to cookies. And one of the ironies of my phone just speaking to me right now when it thought I was speaking to it is that as phones and devices get smarter, as they have AI embedded in them, what we're going to see is the targeting will not occur in the cloud, in the internet, at Google, at Meta. It will occur on your phone without data about you leaving your device. And so AI, which is demonized in other ways right now, may well be a solution to all of this, to say that there is no data passing from you to larger companies, whether that's platforms or advertisers, but advertising can still be targeted to you because a decision about which ad to serve occurs in the AI on your phone. Now, I'm sure that the anti-technology companies will or advocates will find all kinds of evil under the rock there, but it is an attempt to address exactly the problems and issues they have raised to create a new structure where your data is not traversing to anyone else. So what's to complain about? Then I would say if that's the case and if Facebook can prove that, then they shouldn't even have to offer the paid service. They could say that the targeting now has eliminated these supposed harms. That puts the regulatory powers in a very interesting quandary, I think.
The dilemma is that on the one hand, many people, and in probably more in Europe than in the United States, but I think also in the United States, don't really like targeted advertising and all the technology that is behind that. They find it creepy. I mean, this is a emotional issue at the end of the day. On the other hand, the regulator in Europe has never really made an effort of red lines. You know, how far can targeted advertising go? Instead, they are relying, well, at the end of the day, on the consent model. That is, in the critics' words, you are free to be spied on if you give consent. And then, quite sort of oddly, the whole discussion is then about, is the consent freely and voluntarily given? I'm always wondering why, if just sort of from the critic's point of view, when you are so worried about the creepiness of targeted advertising, why don't you demand to ban it altogether? Or if not, to say, well, these are the rules for targeted advertising and you have to follow these rules. I never understand this.
So I think that if you want to see what advertising with no targeting looks like, drive an American highway where there's nothing but billboards. Go to Times Square where there's nothing but lights flashing at you. That's the same for everyone. Right? It's not targeted in any way. It's just there for the whole world. That has no relevance. It's irritating. I don't think people actually want that. I think his argument about creepiness comes out of the moral panic that we started in the Wall Street Journal. I do think, however, that, and I've written this, that the ad industry and the media industry and the technology industry all made a mistake. We enabled cookies to be demonized because we weren't transparent and open about what we were doing, why we were doing it, the benefit of it. Hello, there's a whole bunch of free content for you. And we didn't give people any transparency into what was being gathered, what was being done with it, and any power over something to do with that. The example I used to give, it's now out of date. It's back in the day on Amazon. If I bought my daughter a Taylor Swift CD, back in the days when we had such things as CDs, Amazon would think suddenly that I was a teenage girl and would change what it was recommending to me as a result. But Amazon gave me the opportunity to say, this is why we're doing that. And you can check a box and say, don't use this for recommendations. So I had transparency and I had power. We should have been doing that from the beginning with advertising and targeting throughout the web. It is our mistake that and I say our here again, I mean the media industry, the advertising industry, and the technology industries, all three, that we didn't do that. It enabled the enemy of the internet, Rupert Murdoch, to demonize the cookie. It enabled people to conclude that this was creepy or surveillance or wrong when I don't think it was. So we made that bet and now we got to lie in it. We can't go back. So even though I disagree that it's surveillance, I disagree that it's creepy, I further caution that were it to be banned entirely, what would hurt most is news media. News media that don't have much opportunity for contextual advertising, that have advertisers being in general allergic to them, that though they've been slow to do it, have had some measure of targeting as a result, and they would be hurt. Now, they've already been hurt. In the United States, I just saw a story today that 51% of Americans, by some measure, all use ad blockers now. And I tweeted this and I said, you know, and you're complaining about news being in crisis. You've taken away half the readers in the country have taken away the economic underpinning of reading news. They complain about paywalls. When I link to a paywalled story on social media, people yell at me, it's behind the paywall. Yes, it is behind the paywall. Get used to it, right? And so there is this expectation of getting everything for free. And in the news business, we say, how dare you ask that? How dare you say that? Don't you know how expensive it is to gather the news? True. But if you use Facebook, then you should also appreciate how expensive that is to run. Or don't use it.
This is a sort of interesting question as well. Everybody wants quality journalism, but nobody wants to pay for it.
Right.
The EDPD takes great care of emphasizing that what they are saying only applies to large online platforms, which is something that is unknown to the GDPR. This is a term we have in the Digital Services Act now, but this is not in the competence of the EDPD to make these distinctions. But nevertheless, they stress that. Why do they stress that? Because they are clearly aware that what you are saying is the case. All the German, I'm not sure about the other European countries, but all the German newspaper sites have now two options. You can either have, whether it's now called pure, you can either have Bild or Welt or FATS, or you know them all, Süddeutsche Zeitung, pur, that is without advertising, then you pay a subscription fee, or you can have it with targeted ads. At the end of the day, most of the arguments would also apply to Bild and Welt and Süddeutsche and Zeit, etc. So should this become, for example, by the next decision by the European Court of Justice, you never know what they make of it. They are very privacy friendly. Some would say privacy Taliban friendly. Should this become the opinion of the European Court of Justice one day? I mean, it is sure that activists who are of the moral panic faction would start lawsuits against news media sites doing the same thing. So this will be followed very, very closely by the news media companies here, and it will be followed quite nervously. And I'm aware that this is also already here and there, where there are statements by the German DPAs on these pure models, which they most of these statements say, yes, it's okay with the GDPR, but there are also question marks. So this whole discussion is very, very dangerous.
Well, and you hit to the truth of what's happening here, is that when they aim regulation only at the so-called VLOPs, very large online platforms, almost every one of them is American. And I don't mean to claim that there's anti-Americanism going on here, but there certainly is an anti-Silicon Valley attitude. And I think that there's something very wrong with that. I think you either have a principle or you don't. And if you think the targeted advertising is wrong, then outlaw it for everyone. And if you think it's wrong to charge money to not see advertising, then make that wrong for everyone. But I can guarantee you that Springer and Borda and company would be lobbying hard against such a thing because it would affect them. So they don't have there is not an even playing field here. They always argue that they want an even playing field. Well, it's quite to the contrary. The international companies, the American companies, are at a distinct disadvantage in this discussion.
And I would agree that there are certainly anti-American elements in this discussion. On the other hand, well, surveillance capitalism is a term that was created in the United States. And the reputation of the Big Five has been better than it is now in the United States as well. So it's also about the power that Meta and Google and Amazon have. And there is clearly a power issue there. And I think even in the United States, more than in Europe, questions of trust law are raised to deal with that. But this has all nothing to do with cookies and has all nothing to do with the GDPR. And the GDPR is not the right or the privacy laws have not been created to regulate the market and to open up level playing fields for smaller players, etc. This is not what privacy is really all about.
Well, two things. One, it's not just Shoshana Zuboff and the U.S. Obviously, Max Schrems has been a leader in this in Europe and has led it there. And I think deserves credit or blame, depending upon your perspective, for leading that. And I also think that part of the aim of much of the regulatory and legislative effort we're seeing around the world is to try to disadvantage competitors. It's anti-competitive on behalf of media. It's protectionist. I just wrote a long paper about the California Journalism Preservation Act, which is an effort to get platforms, namely Google and Meta, though Meta will leave news if this happens, mainly then Google, to pay publishers in California and elsewhere a news usage fee, a link tax. This all began, just as I argue that the cookie hatred goes back to Murdoch, this legislative effort goes back to Springer and Borda and the Leistungsschutzrecht and the FAZ, who lobbied for the Leistungsschutzrecht. And even though that ended up coming to nothing as a law itself, it inspired the Spanish link tax. It inspired the provisions of the EU copyright directive. It inspired the Australian bargaining code and Canada's C18, which are all efforts, including the legislation in California and the U.S. and the state of Illinois right now, are all efforts to extend copyright and diminish fair use and to say to internet companies that they may not read content without permission and licensing, even if it's up online for free, that they must pay for it and license it no matter what. And it violates the practices even of journalists. Journalists read each other, learn from each other, use each other's information because information itself cannot be copyrighted. But they're now trying to tell AI companies that you can't even do that. Your systems can't learn from what we do and you must pay us. This is an effort that goes way back in the United States. It goes back a century when the American newspaper industry tried to prevent radio from getting into the news business. They forced two networks to close down their news operations. They required them to agree to only two news updates a day, bought from the newspapers without advertising, so no chance for profit. They had a doctrine that on-air commentators could not talk about a news event until 12 hours afterwards. Newspapers were a very inhospitable neighbor to new competitors and new technologies in radio, in television, in the phone companies, in the internet, and now in AI. And the irony is that these are monopolistic cartel industries in the way they operate. I'm personally offended as a journalist that journalism companies would hire lobbyists to seek favors from the legislators we should be covering independently. But that's the state of where things are now, because the news industry screwed up, did not strategically manage for the internet age, and now is seeking protection against new competitors. That's the essence of what's really happening here.
The California law that I hadn't heard of before that you just mentioned, as you said, sounds like a carbon copy of European legislation, which brings me to another quote from an American author. Is this the Brussels effect? Curiously enough, this is the title of a book by Anu Bradford a few years ago. I now hear it everywhere that Europeans pride themselves with the GDPR as a sort of top trophy of coming up with appropriate regulation for the digital age, with everybody in the whole world copying it.
Yes, and part of the oddity here, I think, is that the EU and the UK, now that they are separate entities, each pride themselves on being world leaders in regulation. Okay, that's a stand, that's a view. But I don't think that leads to innovation and investment and profit and growth. And so when over the years, I've heard Europeans complain that they don't have their own Google. Well, you've got to invest to build your own Google. You've got to enable and allow it to occur. And, you know, I've dealt with startups in Germany over many, many years now. I helped one of my employers invest in them years ago. And what I heard from startup people in Germany consistently is they could get their angel money in Germany, but when it came time to get in any larger investment and risk, they had to go to America. They were selling part of the European innovation to America because they were forced to. They weren't getting the support they needed at home in Europe. So I think that there's a cultural question that has to be grappled with in Germany and in Europe and in the UK about whether you really want to invest in and lead in technology. It's possible. I mean, just look at the question of privacy. There are companies and technologies to be built around privacy. This whole notion of the Google sandbox could have been innovated in Europe, should have been innovated in Europe. It should have been a German company above all companies that would have come forward and say, we understand Datenschutz better than anyone, and we're going to build the technologies and the mechanisms and the companies to protect that and the standards, and we're going to lead. But I didn't hear that. Instead, what I hear is complaint and legislation and regulation, and that doesn't build anything.
Mm-hmm. One last question, Jeff. Let's say in 5 years' time, where will targeted advertising be? Will it still be there?
Important question. And I don't know the answer. I have no idea. I don't believe in such a thing as being a futurist. But I will say this. We have much talk today, especially in local journalism, about it suffering economically and not having a proper means of support. It's happening in Germany. You know, companies like Springer got out of the newspaper business because they were smart and it's not a good business. In the United States now, most of our chains are owned and controlled by hedge funds that do nothing but cut them to the marrow and take away the free cash flow and sell assets and do not innovate. So we're in trouble. So we have a bunch of philanthropies, and we have more of a tradition of philanthropy in the US than in Europe, because we don't have the public media you have in Europe. So philanthropies just joined together to create something called Press Forward to try to support local news with $500 million, $500 million over the next 5 years, which sounds nice. But when you consider that the budget of the New York Times newsroom is over $1 billion, it doesn't go very far. And if you look at the recent purchases by moguls of big publications, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, Sports Illustrated, and Time Magazine, billionaires spent $1.2 billion buying these dying publications in an effort to save them. That money, all of this money, I think could be better put to new and innovative startups. But those startups are going to need advertising support. My nightmare scenario is that advertising as a whole declines because companies can have direct relationships with people online, and that it declines also because of more competition, which is what's already happening on the internet, and that advertisers say, we don't really need media to do this. You look at what's happening in the US. If I go into our large electronics retailer, Best Buy, it's now not so much a store as a giant ad. Over there is Samsung space. Over there is Microsoft space. Over there is Apple space. They're buying that space as marketing. And that's a new form of advertising. If you look at Amazon, it now has more advertising revenue than the entire magazine industry in the world. If you look at Instacart, which enables you to order food to be delivered home, it's now become a major advertising business. Everything is advertising now, other than media. So my nightmare scenario is that advertising declines and the advertising that is left goes to much better, by the way, highly targeted means. Like if I know what you're putting in your shopping cart, I can recommend a different toothpaste to you, and that media get left out. If that happens, on top of the kind of regulation that makes advertising in media nigh unto impossible, then there's not enough generosity from individuals to buy subscriptions. There's not enough generosity from individuals to support charitable efforts like The Guardian. And there's not enough charity from foundations and rich individuals to support the journalism, news, and quality media that we need in the world. That's my nightmare of what could happen to advertising.
I think it's a quote from Jeff Bezos 25 years ago, or if I remember correctly, one day there will only be one book recommendation that is the next book that you will be buying. Something that the moral panic faction will find extremely creepy.
Except the irony is Amazon used to have good recommendations and now they have crappy recommendations. They've gotten worse.
Jeff, this would be a very, very interesting conversation that we will maybe do in some later podcast on the shortcomings of targeted advertising and on the failed expectations that we also have. Just for today, thank you very much for that wonderful talk that we had.
Vielen Dank.
Sehr, sehr gerne.
Das war Follow the Rechtsstaat. Schaltet auch ein bei der nächsten Folge und abonniert.